Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is journalist and writer Anand Giridhas. He's joined in conversation by Recode senior editor Teddy Schleifer. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Anand Giridhas and Teddy Schleifer.
Anand Giridhas is the best-selling author of The True American and India Calling, as well as an editor-at-large for Time, an on-air political analyst for MSNBC, and a visiting scholar at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at NYU. A former columnist and correspondent for The New York Times, he's written for The Atlantic, New Republic, and The New Yorker. Last year, Giridhas published the searing and provocative Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. In it, he suggests that government action, not the generosity of the global elite, is the best solution to some of our most deep-seated problems, and warns that the widening gap between the rich and the poor is a threat to democracy. Appearing in conversation with Anand this evening is Teddy Schleifer, senior editor of Finance and Influence at Recode, where he covers how people of means, first in politics and now in technology, shape the world in which everyone else lives. Please join me in giving them both a very warm welcome to the JCCSF.
San Francisco.
Hey guys, how are you?
How many is everyone?
All good? How many of you guys have read Anand's book? Show of hands. Yeah. Do you want to give a very, I'm sure you've practiced this, do you want to give a very quick, like, 2-minute version of, for people who have not read the book, of your central argument?
Yes. Two things are pretty undeniably true about America today. We live in a golden age of the richest and most powerful people in this country bending over backwards to change the world. Give money back, philanthropy, but not just philanthropy. Inventing all kinds of new modalities of elite do-gooding. Impact investing, which is finance people caring for the people they also screw. Social enterprise, which is businesses that also help society. Here in Silicon Valley, businesses that just claim to be intrinsically humanitarian in their pursuit of profit. It's a monopoly that saves lives. And basically all the stuff that Bono is involved with. And the second undeniably true thing is that that same class of people, in some cases the same people, but certainly the same class of people, the same structure and network of people, has been engaged in the last generation and to this day in monopolizing progress itself in this country. The same class of people has been pushing for public policies that protect its own wealth and power, that ensure that more money goes to corporate earnings than to wages, more money goes to corporate earnings than to taxes. And so I started to become curious about what the relationship was between an age of extraordinary elite generosity, which is real, and which I do not deny, and an age of extraordinary elite hoarding, which they can't deny. And the question is, what's the link? And I think the conventional wisdom out there was, the link is a drop in the bucket. The link is, the hoarding is real, the inequality is real, it's a problem, but they're on the case.
We'll do more.
If only there were 10 Mark Zuckerbergs, not one. If only, I know, scary, right? How much social awkwardness could one world bear? Like we're all paying the price for him just trying to meet girls in a more easy way. It's amazing, like someone should have just introduced him to someone. Donald Trump wouldn't be president if he had just like met someone. And I know this is San Francisco, and this happened at all my events in San Francisco, to shout out to all the people who work at Facebook and the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. You're welcome here. And I appreciate all the leaks you give me at these events and on Twitter, so thank you. I felt that the relationship, I suspected the relationship was actually not the drop-in-the-bucket relationship. That the helping was not on its way to addressing the hoarding. That in fact the helping, the extraordinary helping, was part of how we uphold a system of extraordinary elite hoarding. That the making a difference, which is real, was a wingman of making a killing on a much bigger scale. That the changing the world was a wingman of making sure that their world actually didn't change. And that the doing more good was the wingman of protecting their right on a much grander canvas to do harm. And although I am very opinionated now, I approached this as a reporter, the way you are, and reported this out. And the last thing I'll say is most people, for a lot of obvious reasons, when they're writing about inequality, write about poor people. Right? If you think about the best books ever about inequality, they're actually just about poor people. And there's a reason, because poor people are very nice to reporters. Poor people generally want to be witnessed, want their lives to be seen, because there's a hope that visibility might lead to some kind of change. And rich people do not want anything to change, so they don't want visibility and generally don't let you in. And I thought, but you know, writing about inequality by interviewing poor people is like writing about the architecture of this building by interviewing like some guy in the front row. You don't know anything about the architecture, you're just a guy in the front row. Poor people did not invent the world that made them poor. And so I thought it might be interesting to actually interview the plutocrats and the people around the plutocrats and that network about plutocracy and how it maintains itself. And so I went into their world for a few years, and winners take all is the result.
And this is, I think, often kind of mischaracterized as a book about philanthropy. This is, you're really making a political argument. This entire book is premised on the idea that philanthropy is not enough, so therefore you're not necessarily just critiquing philanthropy as insufficient. Like the obvious conclusion of your book is politics is screwed up. Right?
In addition to being stage friends, we're going to be good friends. Yeah. Because it's so interesting and I get like shorthand is useful, but like in the public eye, it's like the philanthropy book.
Right.
And there's one or two chapters about philanthropy. And then six or seven, I've forgotten because it's been a little time.
But do you think you could agree with you on the philanthropy points and not agree with you on the political point in terms of the conclusion of what you should do? If philanthropy is insufficient, like, is there a world or have you encountered sources or people out there and at events like these who say, you know, I totally agree with you that philanthropy is an insufficient vehicle for social change, but I disagree with you on the solution? And do you think that's like a legitimate point or is that not making
sure,
any sense?
But what I'm describing, and there's a reason, you know, there's a reason this book doesn't have a 10-point plan in the end. First of all, no good book has ever had a 10-point plan at the end. I once said that at an event and then found out that my host at the event had just published a book with a 10-point plan at the end. And I continue to stand by my statement. But look, I think philanthropy is a very flashy and prominent example of what I am trying to show is a much broader thing. So I coined this term for the book called Market World, one word, capital M, capital W. And Market World is a network of people, the people I'm writing about in the book. It includes like billionaires, but it also includes a 22-year-old graduate at Stanford with a lot of debt who's deciding what to do with her life and whether to run for city council or go work at Facebook. And chooses to go work at Facebook. That moment, she becomes part of Market World, too. Market World is a group of people who are among the winners of our age who have two things in common. A, they are sincere about what they understand we live in an age of inequality. They're pissed about it, and they want to do something about it. Okay, so they're not Koch brothers. They actually want to reduce inequality.
Right, right. These are people who are genuinely, at least think they're doing the right thing.
Yes. And I would say most of them vote for Democrats. And most of them, I said this about Jamie Dimon yesterday in Seattle, and I think Jamie Dimon genuinely believes that he's not a slightly handsomer third Koch brother. I think right. He believes this. I genuinely think he believes this. So that's the first thing they have in common. The second thing they have in common is when they pursue the betterment of the world according to their desire to increase justice and equality, whatever. They pursue it in ways that do not change the things that are allowing them to be on the top of the heap. And so if you believe, and in some ways the book is a long brief trying to make this case, that a lot of the reason that maybe most Americans are stuck at the bottom in our time is not that they, you know, fell of their own accord or tripped, but that there's some people standing on them. There's no logical way to talk about lifting them up without making people cease and desist from standing on them. And they stand on them through how they pay people or don't. They stand on them in this city by making them contractors instead of employees, which they actually are. They stand on them by lobbying for public policies that benefit them, create kind of bottle service public policy that is at the expense of 99% of people. And then, having defrauded the society, starved the government of resources, defanged regulation, they turn around, look at the scene, and say, what a shame, all these festering social problems, government's not doing it. Well, this country's been very good to me. Allow me to step in and chip in a little bit. And in that moment, when we allow that, when we receive the check, when we put their name on the wall, we are part of the loop that allows the arsonists to reinvent themselves as firefighters.
So your fundamental solution, if you skip forward a couple steps in the process, philanthropy is insufficient. People are using this to whitewash reputations. Problems are real, which you don't dispute. The fundamental solution is we need higher taxes, more government spending to solve the problems that in a democratic way, in the same sort of generous way. But the argument you're making at the end of the day is for a more, you know, liberal, you know, in the U.S. context, higher taxes, higher social spending.
Yes, but let's be very clear about this, because it's very important that we not be gaslit by the plutocrats into thinking that that agenda is radical. Okay? I don't think Bernie Sanders has proposed a nationalization of a single enterprise in this country. And he's the furthest out person in our national politics. Like, what we are really talking about, in the most extreme version of what I suggest, 99% of activity in this society will remain private activity. I don't want my iPhone made by the government, even though a lot of the underlying technology was enabled by the government, and I appreciate that. I don't want the airplane I'm taking tonight to be flown by the government. Like, there's a whole bunch of things that are private, will remain private. Private transactions are going to be, and by the way, are dominant in, like, Norway also. What we are talking about, what I'm talking about, is the biggest shared problems we have that are, by their nature, not solvable through markets and individual exchange. That is not most things, but dealing with the racial wealth gap and the larger legacy of slavery and segregation and Jim Crow is not a problem solvable by rich people throwing coins.
What happens in a world where, I understand the ideal scenario is to have a more expansive government vision. What happens in a world like today, where, you know, let's put yourself in, you know, year 2019, you know, it's October 29th. There's currently a Republican president, and obviously there will be future Republican presidents. There'll be future times when there's more government services, less government services. In a world where I understand the argument is we need to make sure that we have more a broader impact provided by the government. But sometimes that's not going to happen, right? Sometimes there will be conservative politicians, Republican presidents. What's the role of philanthropy then? Because then you have a situation where the options either fight like hell for a Democratic president and for a liberal government, or philanthropists don't do anything in the meantime. What should people do if the given state is, at a particular time, we're in a Republican or conservative administration?
It's a good question. So a couple things. I want to be very clear that I think as your question indicates, I think a more just America would have fewer billionaires, would have, if any. We could even just try not having billionaires for a little while through better tax policies, and let's try that, and then we can go back to billionaires if we feel like we're really missing something. But I have a feeling the city might get a little more fun if there were fewer billionaires in it. You know, like, how many of those, like, vests can we see these guys, like, bros with their vests, and this is like... And yet, you're right, that we're not going to get to the world I'm talking about now, and there may be periods of history where we don't. And I do think, in those periods, and right now, there is a role for philanthropy. And I'll spell out what I think that is. If you are persuaded by what I'm saying, that we live in a system fundamentally that is allowing the benefits of the future to be cornered by too few people, and you're persuaded that that's a problem, and we're not in a moment where government's going to solve that, you can do philanthropy that would tend towards ending the bad system and hastening the advent of the next system. Or you can do philanthropy that is actually lubricating the bad system and giving it another week, another year of life, right? And I'll give you a couple examples of each. So if you take the issue of feminism and how do we, another great example of a collective shared problem that we can't ask people to solve on their own, okay? How do you dismantle the structures of patriarchy? How do you empower women to play all the roles women need to play and want to play? There is a lot of money chasing fake change in that area. Most prominently, you got Sheryl Sandberg trying to convince women while selling women out to a misogynist president because she didn't want the growth of her company to be interfered with, trying to convince women that thousands of years of patriarchy is a problem of recline. Women were leaning at the wrong angle. If women were to correct their angle of lean, men would completely respect them and there would be no issues. No more groping, no more talking over. Meanwhile, and those kind of initiatives get a lot of money, get a lot of support, lean in circles, get a lot of media, Good Morning America, the whole nine yards. There's meanwhile, like, a bunch of feminist organizations trying to organize for universal daycare, to cite one policy example of something that has been shown in actual countries to actually empower women. But what's the problem with that? Oh, unlike Sheryl Sandberg's thing, which actually just makes Sheryl Sandberg richer, the second thing would make Sheryl Sandberg and everybody like Sheryl Sandberg poorer to do that. Universal daycare would be incredibly expensive. It's the right thing to do, incredibly expensive. And so I just did a deep dive on one of them, but on every issue, education, right? We do charter schools, what happens? We can fundamentally preserve an architecture in which your kids still get to go to better white schools than everybody else's kids, and we don't change that architecture, but we create one black school in your town that's a charter school, and you can mentor, as Darren Walker from the Ford Foundation says in my book, you can tell all your friends you got three black boys into Yale, and you put your name on it, and it's great, and nothing's changed. Or you could do the kind of philanthropy where you're funding the lawyers, and they are out there, who are actually fighting court cases to make it unconstitutional, it's going to take 20 years to do this, to fund public education by local property taxes, which is barbaric and unconscionable, and also the way we do it. It's very interesting.
So some philanthropy you see as less toxic.
I think there is traitor to your class philanthropy,
right,
and there is class protection philanthropy.
Right.
And most of what I see out there is class protection philanthropy.
You're listening to journalist and writer Anand Giridhar, whose book is Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. He's joined in conversation by Recode senior editor Teddy Schleifer on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
What do you think about the idea of, in a conservative administration or in a period of when philanthropy is needed. What do you think about the idea of people who have a conscience and believe in just society giving a lot of money to political causes?
Yeah.
On the one hand, that theoretically, that, you know, political, giving a ton of money to a Democratic super PAC, which is going to spend a fortune to increase taxes, put in a government that's going to be more just. Theoretically, on the one hand, that is class trade or philanthropy. On the other hand, that would raise
Correct.
A ton of concerns about...
It's very complicated. And I write about this a little bit in the book with one of my characters wrestles with this. So there's two sides of this. First of all, whether it's political donations or even within philanthropic giving, there is a case for counter-majoritarian giving. In other words, and that's particularly true under a government like this one. So generally, I want things to be done by the democracy, which is the point we're making, something like universal daycare, right? But there are things where democracies are intolerant and hateful, right? And right now, it's not really a majority, but we're being governed by that kind of thing. And so is helping kids on the border a good use of philanthropy when the government is not only failing to do that, but is avowedly on the other side of that issue? Yes. Right?
Even though that is a Democratic mega donor's influence
Correct.
Being spread.
But to me, it is more justified.
Better of two bad options.
By the fact that it's a counter pressure. However, there's again still a way to do it. There's some ways to do that. And we see this, by the way. There's some ways to work on the border that it's all about the billionaire's swagger and ideas and doesn't actually involve local communities. And there's other ways to structure that same thing where people actually work through civic processes, right? So if you are doing something where you are like running programs, that is very different than if you're doing something if you're like training people from a particular community to run for office.
Even if the total dollar amount is the same.
Yes.
Even if someone gives $20 million.
Yeah. You're basically working through a democratic process. Part of the problem with philanthropy is that it's in some ways a uniquely unaccountable form of power, right? So if you have political power, that's a lot of power, but you have elections, right? And the most powerful person in politics can be gone pretty soon, right? If you're in business, the market is a somewhat ruthless, I mean, not if you have a Silicon Valley monopoly, but like the market imposes a certain kind of discipline. And if you're selling something that nobody wants, you're not here next year. There's no mechanism like that in philanthropy. If you made $50 billion and you want to transform education and your big idea is that science is the only thing we should teach, there's actually nothing stopping you from buying $50 billion worth of that idea. And is some cash-starved district in Arizona going to take your $10 million and like get rid of a bunch of its other humanities classes to take that money? Yeah, of course.
Right.
And I think one of the things that I try to do with this book is make people realize that philanthropy is not all good or not all bad, but is a power flex. And power flexes of all kinds require scrutiny. Rob Reich of Stanford, not too far away, talks about this. You know, we are skeptical of the exertion of military power, even though a lot of people who go into the military are idealistic. Doesn't matter that they're idealistic. Who cares? We watch over them like hawks. Multiple congressional committees, the number of watchdogs, there's an international, you know, war crimes tribunal. Like,
media,
we watch
media, too.
Media.
Right.
Right? How many people in this country are reporters covering that sector of life? Philanthropy is a $400 billion exertion of power a year in the United States, up there with the intelligence community budget, military budget, in that order of magnitude.
Right.
Most publications, you're an exception, most publications do not have a person covering it. What other $400 billion plus exertion of power does not have a single assigned reporter at most publications in America? It's been this place. And the reason it matters is it is a place where, in addition to doing real good, and I am not a denialist of the idea that there's good being done. Those malaria nets are real. They do cover real people's beds. The AIDS drugs are real. Like, a lot of this stuff is real. I have met people benefited by this stuff. I'm sure you have too. But in addition to the good it does, I believe a lot of this elite do-gooding does a couple other things. A, it cleanses names that don't deserve to be clean. And that A, reduces the social cost of having hurt the society. If you're like on the older side and your money-making days are done, it just changes your name and reduces the lifetime cost of having done that. But if you're on the younger side, like a lot of the people you cover, and you're starting your philanthropy in your 30s, but you still got a lot of money-making ahead of you, it actually enables you to keep harming society because you've now improved your reputation and it's lubricant in the engine of continued taking. It also is an undemocratic form of power. Why do we fuss so much about one person, one vote? If in the nightclub of democracy, there's this second line over here where only billionaires can enter and they get 10 million votes each on the same things you are voting about with your one vote, public education, how right. to empower women and girls, et cetera. And so once we start to see a lot of these elite do-gooding activities as A, an exertion of power, but B, as part of how a bad system gets another year of life every year, I think it becomes incumbent on us to not only scrutinize, but to push back against the ways in which we are being abused through acts of helping. To a great degree in this country, rich people are the reason democracy doesn't work.
In the first place. That's
okay.
The...
And this is the big problem. And this is the gaslighting. Okay. The gaslighting is a lot of what I hear from the people with the like venture capital vests is... Pour one out for them. And welcome if you're here tonight. I can't see anything. Dude, I'm totally with you. I love government. Love government. I once went to the White House in eighth grade. But it's just not up to the challenge. So a VC like me has to be deciding things about public education. Now, what this does is it starts with a day one analysis of the problem, when in fact we are late into the problem. Since the 70s, that VC guy and his predecessors and members of his larger
VC
class and community, have been pushing for a world in which government did as little as possible, taxes were as low as possible, regulations were as low as possible, people were as unprotected in the market as possible. And all the predictable stuff happened in that social problems multiply. Turns out you don't give people stable jobs, then they don't have stable lives, and they get evicted from things, and they get addiction issues and end up on government assistance and all the obvious things that are going to happen. And then you step into that scenario and say, what a shame the government's not on the case. Dude, you made it not on the case. You fought tooth and nail for a world in which government could not and would not solve these problems. And now you use the result of what you did to justify your further incursions.
But I guess I'm not necessarily talking about ideology. There's also a question of like competency, right? Some people who would say that even if government was equipped and there was a popular mandate to handle some of these challenges, there's an argument to be made that maybe government is just not capable of it for various
reasons.
But
this is what I'm saying. There are two parts of this. A, it's not... I mean, A, to the extent that it's true, they made it less capable. How do you starve government from... I mean, if you look at the data on what a wealth tax would raise, for example,
right.
the Sanders and Warren wealth taxes are actually fairly modest. Like, people would still get richer every year under both of them, probably. But you look how much money they would raise, trillions and trillions of dollars, right? Like, the idea... to say that government should be equally capable if it didn't have those trillions of dollars or if it did is preposterous. Of course it's incapable of a bunch of things if it doesn't have resources. If I took away half your money, you'd be incapable of a lot of stuff you currently do also.
Right.
A. B, it's not actually true that government is uniquely incapable. And this is something people really don't talk about enough, okay? There is a view out there that people want you to believe that the entire government, federal, state, local. We have 90,000 different government entities in the United States, by the way. And Mitch McConnell controls one of the 90,000. There's a story out there that wants you to believe that all government is essentially the DMV. That's like, but don't you feel like you've internalized that picture? Like it's all, like government is the DMV. Well, here's the truth. As soon as the government solves a problem successfully and permanently, it goes into the category of things we are no longer grateful for and no longer remember. Okay? So I actually want to take a moment to redeem government for a second.
Things that work.
You know, like, let's talk about Silicon Valley. Like, if the claim is that a lot of government activity is not socially useful. A lot of people in government are not having the impact they should. A lot of institutions in government could do more for the well-being of the planet than they do. I would say, sure. And that's true of every sector and every human endeavor. And I spend a lot of time in Silicon Valley, going to a lot of companies, where I see a lot of people also doing things that are of zero social value. So people doing things that are not that socially useful is just sort of common to human beings, regardless of, you know, in every sphere, there are some minority of activities that have a disproportionate impact, okay? But, you know, the United States court system, when's the last time you thought about it? Hopefully for you, not recently, is a remarkable institution that almost none of us think about, that great stories don't get written about, that completely underpins everything all of us did today. The fact that any of these businesses can function, and that many of them could not function, where you work, could not function in a bunch of countries in the world, could not have been founded in those countries, is precisely because of how contract law works in America. When was the last time you were grateful for contract law? It's settled. It just works. The fact that the Securities and Exchange Commission looks into, not perfect, doesn't jail enough bankers, but like basically polices the investment markets so that you can have reasonable certitude that your pension is not like fake stocks, which in some countries could happen, but does not happen in this country, is the result of remarkable government activity that is ongoing every day. The fact that Social Security keeps millions and millions of people out of poverty, the fact that you know, we actually successfully, through the New Deal state, did many programs that are in effect to this day, cushioning people from the vicissitudes of life and the market. These things are so successful that we don't appreciate them, kind of like our parents. And I feel that's like the perfect JCC comment to make.
Love your parents.
Like, catering to the like underappreciated parents market. That was pandering, I admit.
You're allowed one blatant pander.
And so, like, I don't accept the premise that government's not effective. I look at the life I have been able to have in this country as being very much a product of this being one of the most successful machineries of state in the history of human civilization, with flaws, with limitations, with unfinished business, with right now a really terrible president. And even under the terrible president, much of that system is unaffected and brilliant and completely unappreciated.
Let's talk a little bit about kind of Silicon Valley specifically. You mentioned earlier that, you know, you're trying not to tar with a broad brush. You mentioned Bill Gates. Obviously, he's held up in philanthropy circles as the one guy who's got it right. You know, there's a lot of wandering by rich people as they try to figure out how they should give their money away. Bill Gates is, you know, runs the biggest foundation in the world. He's been doing it for 20 years. The conventional wisdom is he's their best case scenario for how philanthropy can change the world. I'm curious if there's anybody else beyond Bill Gates who you think of as doing a good job.
I think we should stick with Gates for a second, okay, because it illustrates something.
I have a feeling I know where you're going with this, based on some of your tweets.
Right. First of all, I think it is true that unlike certain people, unlike, I would say, the Sackler family, members of the Sackler family, unlike the Zuckerberg kind of example, you have in Bill Gates someone who did not make the money through that kind of acute social harm. Now, to be clear, and we've forgotten this, Microsoft was a monopoly.
Right, some people would argue.
And a bully. It's not killing hundreds of thousands of people in an opioid crisis, right? I mean, there's a question of degree here. I think the monopoly is a bigger deal than people remember, in the sense that, you know, actually an ex-Microsoft very senior person came up to me at one of my events, and I had said something kind of making this point. And he was like, yeah, you're right. It's not, monopoly is not murder. But he's like, what it basically means is that for a certain period of time, you give no oxygen to anybody who wants to start a company in a pretty large area. And you think about like all the immigrants who came to this country and studied and wanted to start something that was in their orbit and like never started that company and maybe went back to their country because like there was only allowed to be one company in that area. So monopoly is real, and he was one, and he was, you know, sued by the Justice Department. So like, let's remember that. But that said, I'll stipulate that I think he's not, on the money-making side, not the extreme case of social harm. And on the do-gooding side, is more serious about it. This is not Goldman Sachs giving $2 million to some women's shelter to cover up the way in which it caused millions of women to lose their home in the financial crisis. This is like real strategic analytical giving. It's very clear. Have you ever seen an interview? Like, this guy bleeds for this stuff. It's the intellectual priority of his life. He cares, right? So let's stipulate all
that. Do you agree that given in the of all the donors out there, do you agree that he's their best argument?
No.
You think there's someone better?
But hold on. So I don't think he's a Sackler, okay? The question is, are there still residual issues if we take that off the table? He's not narrowly doing this to change his name. He's sincere about it. He's doing real work. Are there still issues? And I think the following two issues still remain. Issue number one is, it is no matter how you made the money and no matter how effectively you're spending it, to me, it is still too much power for a private, unelected individual over public life. Plain and simple, right? It is undemocratic. Or if it's not undemocratic, then why do we bother to limit other forms of private power if like some rich person gets to just re-decide public school policy? To me, it's just inherently undemocratic, right? And I would say, like, even if you take someone who absolutely did not harm anybody by making money, Serena Williams, if she did Bill Gates' education activity, I would have the same concern about why should any one person get to decide things that we should all be deciding together, okay? Second issue. In playing in the do-gooding social change world the way someone like Bill Gates does with that level of power, someone like Bill Gates inevitably changes our conversation about change. This is a very important point to understand. Changes the terms we use, right? Changes the kind of what is valorized and what is not. Changes the moral valence that something like a teacher's union might have versus something like a charter school might have. And in so doing, all of us end up unwittingly participating in a cultural landscape that is rigged. And I think it's very important to think about that Gates example, because even if these people are not problematic in the money-making side of life, which I think he is, but even if we stipulate they're not, it's still problematic. And I also think, and this may be what you were getting at with the tweets, the fact that he, one of the greatest advocates and warriors for children on earth, had the profound misjudgment to spend a significant amount of time with Jeffrey Epstein after he was a convicted child rapist, sexual predator, and was not forthcoming about it when called out about by The New Yorker and others, to me raises profound questions, not about his ability to decide big things for humanity, but about any flawed human being's ability to decide big things for humanity. I'm not saying he's unique in the misjudgment he showed. I think it was terrible. But I think that is the whole reason why we don't have kings. And through this kind of philanthropy thing, we've allowed ourselves to have these private kings.
Right. So who's a good example of someone who you think is, you know, if you stipulate that someone's going to have, you know, maybe not however much Gates has, but, you know, a billionaire. Is there an example out there of a billionaire who you think is, who's doing the least harm to society with their giving?
Here is, I have to apologize in advance, but, like, here's why I can't do that. Because I don't know all of their practices, and I know what's going to happen if I do that, is tomorrow morning, there will be some story about how the person I named, like, actually, like, bought the Cayman Islands' Treasury Department, and, you know. And so, like, I don't want to endorse a person whose, you know, whose entire books I haven't seen. But I do think there are people out there, you know, an organization that I think is very interesting is Resource Generation. Uh-huh. There are organizations out there thinking about how do you, if you do happen to have this money, but you agree with a lot of what I'm saying, how do you spend it in ways that would help dismantle the system? There are people out there thinking about traitor to your class philanthropy. And there are causes that you can give to if you're one of those people.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is journalist and writer Anan Giridas, whose book is Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. He's joined in conversation by Recode senior editor Teddy Schleifer. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Someone like a Mark Benioff would, well, I mean, obviously he's...
So I'll give you an example with Benioff that I think is interesting. Like, Mark does a bunch of standard, I would say standard market world stuff. Like, I think it's been called 111, which is like 1% of profits, right? That's the kind of standard playbook, like business. And he says, like, business is the greatest platform for change. Now, I think he is completely wrong about that. But that's what he says. And like, so he does some stuff around that. But more recently, he got involved in this city, in the homelessness issue, and he specifically got involved in advocating for a higher tax on companies to fund the homelessness issue.
Benioff almost seems like the least market-oriented major tech philanthropist
and there's some,
of them out here.
But I think what's interesting is, and I've had conversations with him about this, I think in his mind these were just two different things he was doing. And it was like, no, the second thing is actually system change. And the first thing is fine, but it's fundamentally part of a kind of feudal model of business throwing coins while refusing to change the system. Raising taxes, fixing these larger structures, gets you to a different place. And we have seen, he's not the only one. Eli Broad came out in favor of, I think, a wealth tax. You had a letter from Abigail Disney. There's Pritzker people. Like, there have been more calls for not just higher income taxes, but wealth taxation. I actually have conversations with a lot of these folks, Abigail and others, who've read the book and grappled with it and try to figure out where to land on some of these issues.
Right.
And I think where the most thoughtful people in that world land, in my view, is when they land on, you know what, like the answer to a winners take all world is actually winners taking less. And the only way to do that is not me throwing coins at people, but actually having it coerced through government action, through taxation.
Because this is a question you get all the time, and we're talking backstage about what's the solution. Like, if you're a billionaire and you have $5 billion, and you're trying to, you know...
I accept the premise.
You have the money. What are they supposed to do with it, right? I mean, I know you get this question all the time, but, like, do you recommend they send it to the IRS? Do you recommend that they... Seriously, like throw it out? Because, I mean, you have a world where the wealth exists, and this goes back to our previous question about what do you do in a conservative administration. Mark Benioff can't change U.S. policy by himself, right? Mark Benioff could decide to spend a lot of money to advocate for Democratic candidates, which he does. He could decide to somehow take less personally at Salesforce. He could decide to no longer do CSR initiatives with the Salesforce Foundation. But what is an individual actor, if you agree the problem, there's a problem, what is an individual person, one of 330 million people in the U.S., what should they do?
A couple things. First of all, towards the end of the book, I interview this brilliant Italian political philosopher, Chiara Cordelli, at the University of Chicago. And she says, you know, these people, talking about the plutes, she says, you know, these people have a concept of agency that doesn't make sense. When the project is to capture governmental power and fight for lower taxes or less regulation or a loophole, then they're very down with system change and they understand perfectly how to do it and they're all up in there. When it's like, how do I raise the taxes that I fought to lower earlier? Or how do I restore the regulation that I fought to repeal earlier? Suddenly it's like, you know, I'm just one person out of 330 million... I hear this all the time. Like, what do I know about the political sphere? Well, y'all literally did the things you're trying to reverse. I don't know. How'd you do the things in the first place? Same playbook, probably. Same lobbyists. Just ask them to do the opposite of what they did. So I just want to say as an overall point, because I actually, like, Mark Benioff, I think, tried, like, one initiative to raise taxes, and it succeeded, and now taxes are higher. So, like, I think these people can actually get a lot done. The same way they got stuff done the wrong way. So that's the overall point. In terms of what to do, I have a two-part answer for you. Part one is, first, unwind your complicity. Okay?
Stop doing bad stuff.
Stop doing bad stuff. That is, and the partial list would be, like, do a complicity audit of your company. All right, here's what a complicity audit would start to ask. Not exhaustive, but right? Like, how are you paying people? How much are you paying people? How precariously are you paying people? Are you making people contractors, not employees? All those shenanigans, right? Taxes, second part of the complicity audit. Are you using the double Irish with a Dutch sandwich? Stop using that sandwich. Are you using like weird Caribbean islands that you are not actually like interested in being part of the community? You know, the whole set of things you can do around taxation. Lobbying. What are you lobbying for as a company? By the way, this is a question employees of companies should ask, because employees generally have no idea what their company are lobbying for on behalf of their work product. They're just doing the work product, right? And often companies are asking for things in Washington that are so destructive. I once spoke after at this conference of business and society round something like that, and the woman who'd spoken before me was from like the Coca-Cola Clean Water Initiative. Perfect warm-up act for me. And I was like, I don't doubt that the woman who just spoke to you, that her little part of Coca-Cola, I'm going to stipulate, although I don't know, that her little part is a net good for the world. I don't know that to be true, but I'm going to stipulate that the Coca-Cola clean water thing in isolation is like better than not having it. The problem is there is someone else at Coca-Cola with a nicer suit than her who is fighting for things to be slipped into the federal budget and trade deals with Mexico and China that is having an effect on the world, a thousandfold the effect of what the clean water woman is able to achieve. So look at your lobbying. So step one is unwind complicity. Stop doing things that are actively making the world worse first. Second, if you still have a little stamina in you, begin advocating. As a rich person, as a CEO, as a person who is in the plutocracy, begin advocating at a systemic level for the kinds of structural changes that would solve this problem universally, publicly, democratically, institutionally, and lobby for them with all the might that you might have otherwise lobbied for things that were of private benefit. You know, I have shared this elsewhere. Like, I got this random phone call or email, which led to a phone call from Jamie Dimon in August, who didn't like the fact that I questioned his big business roundtable initiative, which said that, you know, all these companies claiming that shareholders are not the only be-all and all of business. It's about stakeholders now, too. It's like the business world realizing what every four-year-old understood, which is, like, you should, like, care about people. And he didn't like that I gave the skeptical quote, so he, like, had this phone call. And I basically kept saying to him on this phone call, if you really believe business should care about the environment, care about people, we have an amazing way to make sure that happens, which is called the law. It's called policy, right? That way it doesn't depend on Jamie Dimon, like, feeling handsome a particular morning. I don't want, like, your pay to depend on whether he's feeling handsome on a Tuesday. And so that's the whole point of regulation. So if he's doing this stuff, but then in Washington, J.P. Morgan or the Business Roundtable representing these 180-some companies is lobbying against forcing companies to be more stakeholder-minded, you're undoing this little virtuous claim. So unwind complicity and then actually begin proactively advocating for the kind of structural changes that might be bad for your class but good for the Republic.
So when you see, so a good example of that would be there's kind of a class of billionaires, probably most prominent is probably George Soros, who's basically calling for a wealth tax. Like that to you fits the bill of advocacy that who knows if they really are going to, you know, it's very easy to sign an op-ed, right? But like who knows whether or not they're actually going to be advocating for this with might.
But again, the how is important, right? So if you want to spend $100 million pushing towards a wealth tax,
right?
There's some very plutty ways to do that. Like,
right, because like obviously that you could argue that distorts democracy, spending $100 right. million. For
and again, I'm not saying that I'm like on that issue. I think it's complicated. And like I think if you are fighting against your own class interests, I give you a much freer pass to exert political influence because it's just not selfish in the same way.
So Michael Bloomberg would sort of qualify too? Not on wealth issues, but on guns issues or immigration issues.
But then he uses the guns issues.
Right.
You know what he said to Elizabeth Warren backstage at this gun safety forum? Do you know the story? So he has this gun safety forum. This is such an important example of how this whole thing works and why the woke billionaires are as problematic as the regular billionaires. So he has his gun safety forum that I guess he's one of his organization.
Every town
yeah. is like one of the sponsors.
I think he's all the money behind it.
Was he all the money, right?
I believe so, yeah.
So Elizabeth Warren and others speak at this forum. And I didn't see her talk, but I think she gave not only a gun thing, but probably her standard critique of plutocracy and money and a lot of the stuff you've heard like less eloquently tonight. And backstage, and he shares this anecdote with pride. Like, that's the great thing about guys like that. Like, they're not embarrassed.
I remember watching
by
it live.
By their barbarism.
He gets up on stage and, right. you know, here's his repartee.
I appreciate that about right. men like that. It's like, yeah. So transparent about their vulgarity. So he comes on stage and says, I just saw her backstage, and I said to her, you know, if I hadn't been really successful in my business... And I put on that, like, vest picture. If I hadn't been successful in my business, we wouldn't have this forum. So, you know, nice speech, but enough already. Okay. Now, a little casual moment, a little flip. But think about it. Just unpack it for a second. Because I actually think you could tell the whole story that we're talking about here through that encounter. What he is saying, he is using the do-gooding he does to say, because I sponsor this forum philanthropically, I'm giving you a chance to speak at my forum, which assumes that somehow she doesn't have other places to speak as a top-tier presidential candidate. I, this man, am giving you, this woman, a voice, which is pretty preposterous given that she has a much bigger voice than he does right now. And therefore, because I am doing that, which we've already... explored how dubious the claim that he's even doing that is, but because I'm doing that for you, you should stop questioning the system that allowed me to make the money that gave you this platform, which is actually not that much of a platform for her. That is the move, people. This is, if you take away one thing, you got to understand that these are not separate things. Him making his money in the system we have and then him being a woke philanthropist are not unrelated. In that moment, the mask slipped. He used the do-gooding to justify the system of extreme taking. Don't talk about this, because if you talk about this, I'm not going to give you a stage to share your ideas. Right? It's that loop that makes me as skeptical, if not more, of the billionaires we're supposed to trust. So on Soros or others, if they want to work on $100 million to advocate for a wealth tax, the key thing is to think about what is the least plutocratically enhancing way to do that. Even though the policy substantively is anti-plutocratic, that, I give you a lot of credit just for that, but there are still ways to do it that would have your opinions dictate. But let's imagine instead that $100 million would be spent on recruiting and training a generation of pro-tax candidates to run for local, state, and federal office over the next 20 years, that would, to me, be an example of something that was just a little less pluty, because your money would be going into the system and affecting something, but for it to work, people would have to actually win elections, which right. would mean that the filtration of democracy would be legitimating.
As opposed to like giving the money to a super PAC.
And tipping an election
right, right.
that you wouldn't otherwise have won.
Gotcha. Are you disappointed at all that like presidential candidates are not talking about, obviously their candidates talking about a wealth tax, but like the issue around billionaires and billionaire philanthropy is not something people are talking about explicitly. You know, there's a lot of conversation now around kind of these foundations that exist, whether or not these foundations should be existing in perpetuity. There's a debate about donor-advised funds, but this is still pretty niche stuff. Like, is there a part of you that wishes that like there was a much more explicit political conversation around the horrors of philanthropy, or will we get there in 20 years?
I mean, it's interesting. Like, I understand why people running for office for president don't get super into the weeds on an issue. I would actually say I'm actually incredibly satisfied
with the conversation in this primary. I actually think this Democratic primary is a real referendum on capitalism and structural change in a way that I feel we have not been treated to in my lifetime. So I'm actually, we're not talking about philanthropy, which is maybe a little niche for the game they're playing, but we are absolutely talking about, like, whether we should even have billionaires.
Right. It's been a question at one of the CNN town halls.
That was a Reddit, the darker sides of Reddit conversation a year or two ago. That is now a main stage presidential debate question. The last debate I was very struck. I think this was kind of newsworthy. All the people who are not for a wealth tax basically said, I'm sort of for a wealth tax. I just haven't put one out yet. Right? Which is sort of interesting. So the Overton window has really moved. And I actually feel this primary has been a remarkable exposition of two theories of change. A win-win theory of change, which is kind of the theory that my book is attempting to dismantle, and a theory that actually understands that real change in a moment like this involves the loss of power, and that you can't fight for the people below without cramping the style of the people standing on their necks. And just as you cannot address patriarchy and the Me Too movement without restricting and dealing with the power and impunity of men and limiting it, reducing it, just as you can't end white supremacy and deal with racism without reducing the power and impunity of white people, there's no way to reduce the power of... There's no way to fight plutocracy without making the plutocrats less wealthy and powerful. And so in this race, you have two candidates who are basically questioning, in Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, the win-win premise. And they are saying the only way to do right by most of us is to actually make some people less influential and powerful and even wealthy than they are right now. And then you have a bunch of other people who are kind of offering the same win-win Democratic Party stuff of we can lift everybody up together and we can somehow pull the guy on the floor up without affecting, per Joe Biden, without changing anything fundamental for the person standing on their neck, which is a remarkable feat of physics if he's able to pull it off.
Great. All right.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was journalist and writer Anand Giridhas, whose book is Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. He was joined in conversation by Recode senior editor Teddy Schleifer. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.